Thank you very much. I'd like to thank the organizers for inviting me to speak here. thanks, Wong. And take this opportunity to thank all of you for coming from near and far on a very special day when most of you probably would rather be at home working on your taxes. Okay, but in case I see some laptops open, some of you still have TurboTax fired up, don't worry, I'll try not to distract you too much. Okay. So what I'm going to talk about is some work with Mike Mulligan, who's a postdoc at MIT, and Shamit Khatru, professor at Stanford. And I'm going to introduce this by telling you a little bit about how I first met Mike, which occurred one day back in, I think it was 1999, when my telephone rang, and I picked up the phone. This is my office phone rang, and I picked up the phone. And on the other end, a guy said, "Hi, my name is Mike Friedman. I'm a mathematician, Microsoft Research, interested in quantum computation. I've been reading one of your papers, and I was hoping I could come by and visit you at your office in LA." Okay. And then a few weeks later, he showed up at my office, and he said, "So I'm interested in the physics of modular tensor categories," which I didn't take to be an auspicious start particularly. But as he was talking, he then got distracted, and he said, "Oh, is that a photograph of Mont Blanc? You notice a photograph of my mouth?" And then things improved, okay, from that point. So fast forward, you know, about 12 years, okay, and nowadays a more typical thing is my cell phone rings, and he says, "Hi, Chetan, it's Mike. Say, I'm wondering, is the velocity of an edge excitation in the 5-half state, is that around 10 to the 5th meters per second?" Okay. So there's some lessons you can draw from this. One of them is, okay, telecommunications technology has changed a lot. Okay? You can be reached many places besides your office. The second thing is that whatever has happened in the last 12 years cannot be described as unitary evolution. Something has happened, okay? And now Mike is a condensed matter physicist, as far as I'm concerned. And actually, well, the other thing is that a lot of my pictures of the mountains have Mike in them, too. Okay? So I'm going to make it official here now. In fact, you're now going to be a card-carrying condensed matter physicist, Mike. There you go. You're now a physicist. Okay. I would have tried to lie about the date of birth a little bit, but unfortunately, it's not going to fly here. So let me now segue to something a little bit different. And the reason I'm talking about this in part is because this actually starts, or my involvement in this story actually starts around when Mike and I, when I first met Mike, at which time, you know, Mike was very interested in trying to build a quantum computer, but didn't know what physical system might be amenable to that. So he and I, and around the same time, Alexei Katayev, of course, and Kirill Shtengel, we were all independently together playing with various microscopic models. An effective field theory that arose in that description is what Paul Fenley and Eddie Ardona and Eduardo Fradkin, I think, were the first to call it the quantum Lifshitz theory. And it's a simple scalar field theory like this, okay? With the unusual feature that you are now considering the grad squared term possibly changing sign. Okay, so usually this has some sign that's positive, the coefficient isn't very important, you scale it out, and then you worry about higher order terms, okay, powers of 5, 5 to the 4th maybe. But here you really focus on this changing sign. When it's positive, it's sort of the usual case. The ground state is one in which spatially homogeneous. On the other hand, if R goes negative, it's favorable for the system to develop a non-zero tilt. Okay. This model arises, for instance, in the effective field theory descriptions of the quantum dimer model, which was cooked up by Steve Kivelson and Dan Rockstar, which is a model originally proposed for high-temperature superconductivity, in which these dimers on a lattice are supposed to signify where there are singlet bonds between spins, antiferromagnetically interacting spins, and those dimers resonate in some way and also have some energetic penalty for coming close together, And this, there's a lot of interesting physics here, an interesting phase diagram, beautiful work by Chris Henley, which really is what made the connection with the field theory I wrote in the previous slide, and beautiful work by Roderick Mercer and Shivaji Somvi about the triangular lattice version of this. The interesting thing is, if you look at that critical point, so if you focus on the critical point where r equals 0, then the next leading gradient term is has four derivatives. And this theory has many interesting properties, including the fact that the ground state wave function has this, can be written down exactly, and has the form of the Boltzmann weight for some kind of height model. Okay? And so this leads to interesting connections with classical statistical mechanics. So this is a 2 plus 1 dimensional theory, but its ground state looks a lot like classical statistical mechanics in 2 plus 0 dimensions. There's actually interesting versions of gauge gravity duality that have this kind of symmetry. Nice results by Eduardo Fradkin and his collaborators on universal log corrections to entanglement entropy for such states. So there's many interesting properties here. It happens to have a dual description, which is going to be useful for what I'll talk about. So in 2 plus 1 dimensions, particles and vortices are dual to each other. And so by representing the current, this has a conserved charge, representing the U1 current as a curl of some gauge field, you can rewrite the action from the previous slide in the following form. Okay, the first couple terms are essentially a complicated, one, two, three, four terms are essentially a complicated way of rewriting Maxwell's equations. If I were to integrate out the electric field, which is here treated as an independent variable from the vector potential, you would get back to the usual Lagrangian of Maxwell's equations. But it's convenient to treat them as independent variables precisely for the case where r equals 0, okay, or negative. Okay. So there's higher gradient terms and an e to the fourth term, which stabilizes this theory. Okay, so we're going to switch gears a little bit and talk about a different gauge theory, which is Chern-Simons theory. It's a purely topological theory. There's no propagating modes, nothing like a photon, and its sole purpose in life of the Chern-Simons gauge field is to attach flux to charge. So this is supposed to signify flux tubes attached to charges, and as a result of that, it turns these particles into anions, okay, depending on the coefficient here. Now, if you consider a theory which has not just the Chern-Simons term, but both Chern-Simons and Maxwell terms, so this is in a different form, the Lagrangian for Maxwell's equations, this is the Chern-Simons term, it has fewer derivatives, and by power counting it's more relevant, so at low energies, you expect it to dominate. If you look at, let's say, the propagator, the correlation functions of the gauge field, they're massive. The Chern-Simons coupling basically acts like a mass term. So you can kind of forget in the far infrared, forget about the Maxwell term. Okay. Now, Occam's razor, which is, I guess he wrote it in Latin originally, but I'll translate it for you into English. Entities must not be multiplied beyond necessity. Okay, but he didn't say we shouldn't add them. So let's add those two theories. That's perfectly well allowed. So we can take this dualized form of the Lipschitz theory, okay?
You're cheating because the S usually is in the exponent.
Okay, I'll give you that. Touché. And here, of course, is the Chern-Simons term. We add them together, and you might naively expect, well, you know, Chern-Simons has fewer derivatives, and it's basically like a mass term, so we should be able to just forget about the Lipschitz terms here. But that's not true. Okay. In fact, this theory is scale invariant. The correct scaling here is a non-relativistic one in which the time scales with two powers of the distance. And this is a perfectly scale invariant theory. Both terms scale the same way. Okay. You can compute the propagators if you prefer, and you'll see that there's all these poles at omega equals p. There's no mass here. Okay. And this theory is, of course, a special point. It's a critical point of a theory in which r is allowed to be positive, negative, or 0. And it's the critical point at which the coefficient of the e squared term goes through 0. Okay. And the interesting thing about this theory, as far as this talk is concerned, is the fact that although on both sides of the transition, the Chern-Simons term might be expected to dominate, okay, because just the way the scaling works, right at the transition, the Chern-Simons term and the Lifshitz dynamics compete on more or less equal footing. Okay. So, as I said, on both sides of transition, those you expect the Chern-Simons term to dominate. If you compute something like the conductivity, okay, where again you assume that the conserved current is the electromagnetic current, then for r greater than zero, really those higher derivative terms are unimportant. It's just Maxwell Chern-Simons. You can integrate out the E field and have something purely in terms of A, and it's basically a quantum Hall state. If you go to the omega goes to zero limit, sigma xy is basically 1 over k, fractional quantum Hall state, and sigma xx goes to zero. So this is kind of what you expect. On the other hand, for r less than zero, there's a Goldstone mode, because the system spontaneously chooses a direction in which to put that dual electric field. That's arbitrary direction, and so there's a Goldstone mode associated with the spontaneous breaking of rotational symmetry. And strangely, because of that Goldstone mode, you end up with rather different looking transport properties. It looks more or less like a superconductor in one direction and an insulator in the other direction. Okay. Now, you might think that that's basically an artifact of the fact that we've written down a model that has a continuous rotational symmetry. In a real system, there would be a lattice, there'd be disorder. So if we lowered the symmetry in the action to, let's say, the symmetry of the square lattice by putting in, for instance, ex to the fourth plus ey to the fourth terms, then that changes the transport on the r less than zero side of the phase transition. It now becomes a nice quantum Hall state again. And the anisotropy, which was quite dramatic when we assumed full rotational invariance, is much milder. It's still a good quantum Hall state. But if you look at finite frequency, there's a difference between sigma xx and sigma yy. Okay. Now, right at the critical point, a strange thing happens, which is that although the gap is collapsing at the critical point, or at least coming from one side of the transition, the gap is collapsing, and in the D4 symmetric version, the gap is collapsing, the system becomes more, not less insulating, which is counter to intuition. However, it's essentially happening because as you go to that critical point, the electromagnetic field is coupling less and less strongly to the system, okay? Basically through derivative coupling. So it's a peculiar critical point in which there's no gap, but it's less conducting than it is on either side of the transition. Okay? And this is independent of frequency. So it's an interesting curiosity, and that was sort of where it was. But then kind of a funny thing happened on the way to HEPTH, which is that we heard about these beautiful experiments by Jim Eisenstein and Jing Sha and collaborators, in which they looked at the 7/3 fractional quantum Hall state. So it's a fractional quantum Hall state with Hall conductance 7/3 times E squared over H. It's in the second, or the N equals 1 Landau level, which is quite different from the lowest Landau level. In the lowest Landau level, many different quantum Hall states are observed, dozens. In the second Landau level, just a few. The 5/2 state, which many of us here are very interested in, is the most prominent of them. 7/3 is another important state there. And what they did was they, in addition to the magnetic field perpendicular to the plane, which is necessary to have the quantum Hall effect, they also put an in-plane field. And what they found is, unlike in at 5/2, where putting on even a small in-plane field kills the state completely, okay, for reasons that I don't think are fully resolved yet, but perhaps has something to do with spin physics, maybe has something to do with the effect on the motion of the wave function in the z direction. But at any rate, it kills the 5/2 state. Well, what happens here is it does not kill the state. You can see there's a plateau here, which is still there, even for quite large values of the tilted field. So if you just look at this, you'd say, well, nothing much really interesting happens. However, when they put on this tilted field, RxX and RyY, that is the longitudinal resistances, diverge dramatically from each other. Okay. This, if you were just looking at, so if you looked at the previous slide, you would have said, well, nothing interesting happens. If you look at just this slide, you would say, well, okay, this is like one of these anisotropic states in higher Landau levels, which in 10 or 15 years earlier, Jim Eisenstein and friends discovered. And also, in fact, if you look at the 5/2 state, when you destroy it with this in-plane field, it goes into an anisotropic state like this, at least initially. Okay? So this is a kind of a peculiar thing that has some features of these highly anisotropic states, and yet, in exactly the same temperature range, in which is very anisotropic, and in which RIY is clearly decreasing strongly, and RXX is, looks like it's blowing up at the lowest temperatures, it's a perfectly good quantum Hall state. So as you can see in this slide from Jim Eisenstein, as you lower the temperature, this Hall plateau is getting better and flatter, and RYY is going down to zero, and RXX is starting to take off. Okay. So this is a pretty strange thing. Okay, you've got a quantized Hall plateau, and you've got seemingly a hard and easy direction. So this is now starting to look vaguely reminiscent of the R less than zero phase of that Lifshitz-Chern-Simons theory that I wrote down. Okay, but in that calculation I showed, there was no interesting DC transport, longitudinal DC transport. There was some anisotropy that showed up in finite frequency, but there was nothing interesting in the DC. So it's vaguely reminiscent, but not the same, obviously. Okay. On the other hand, we shouldn't expect anything interesting in DC longitudinal transport, since we have no charge matter fields in that theory. It's purely the Chern-Simons theory, and we believe that probably it's the charge matter fields that are relevant for that kind of transport. Okay. Also, another important difference is in what I showed you in Lifshitz-Chern-Simons theory, it is, of course, both sigma xx and sigma xy, sigma yy are zero at zero temperature. So although there's some anisotropy at finite frequency, they eventually both go to zero. And here in this data, there's no sign of rxx going to zero. Okay? Even as the plateau is getting very good and ryy is going to zero, rxx, as far as I understand, at the lowest temperatures, still looks like it's going up. Okay? So anyway, if we want to really try to use this theory to understand these experiments, we of course have to look at DC transport a little more seriously. And so we can take the action that we had before and couple it to some charged matter field, some simple model. I have changed the notation slightly here. What I was calling A, I'm now calling N, just to distract you from TurboTax, those of you who are out there still working on that. And I've introduced some charge matter fields as well here, with an energy-energy coupling between the dual electric field and the charge matter field. So some way for the anisotropy to be communicated from those gauge fields to the matter field. And when you do that, okay, what you find is that you'll find a, and we phenomenologically put in some scattering rate for the quasi-particles. You'll find that rho xy is perfectly well quantized, okay? And rho xx and rho yy are given by the conductances of kind of the opposite conductances of the quasi-particles. This just comes about from inverting that matrix that you get. Okay. And furthermore, you can compute, just in lowest order perturbation theory, what these are, okay, the effect on these due to the coupling to that gauge field, and you see that it's anisotropic, and in fact, this could be a dramatic effect very close to the finite temperature transition at which this takes off. Okay. So now this is starting to look a little bit more serious. Okay. That's really just kind of still a hint of perhaps things to come. To give a little bit intuition in this, it would be nice to know, okay, this is an interesting theory. It's vaguely reminiscent of the experiments. I will say an important difference, okay, is that although there's anisotropy, which can actually be fairly dramatic, very close to the transition, both of these do go to zero at zero temperature, unlike what's seen in the data. Okay. So if this has something to do with the data, eventually that initial divergence will have to, they will both have to come back and go to zero, okay, together. If this theory has anything to do with those experiments, that is. Okay. So, fine. So we'd like to know why we should think about this theory at all in terms of these having anything to do with these experiments other than this kind of vague resemblance. Well, we can take a more microscopic picture. So one way of deriving, for instance, these kinds of Chern-Simons theories is to follow in the footsteps of Zhang, Hansen, and Kivelson and related work by Nick Reed, in which you transform the electrons interacting, moving in a magnetic field into a collection of bosons interacting with a Chern-Simons field, and interacting and now moving in net zero field. And if you assume that the effective theory of long wavelengths has roughly the same form as this microscopic theory, okay, this is just an exact rewriting of the electron problem, but if you assume that along wavelengths the effective theory has roughly the same form, then the boson, if it's the coefficient of its quadratic term is negative, will condense and you get a quantum fractional quantized Hall state. Okay. What we'd like to say is, well, let's imagine the same thing, but for reasons that we don't at present understand, let's imagine that the term at long distances is of the same form as this mass term becomes negative for some reason. And we don't understand why, but let's just imagine that it does. You would need to then put in some higher derivative terms like this to stabilize the theory. Okay? But let's imagine that this happens and see what you get. Well, what you find is that you recover precisely that Lifshitz, Chern-Simons theory that I wrote down earlier, meaning you can, in either of the two phases or at the transition, you can dualize that theory and get back the theory I wrote down. Or alternatively, you could simply compute response functions from this theory directly and see that they're the same. Okay. One nice thing about having a microscopic theory like this is that you can, or a more microscopic at least theory like this, is you can, for instance, write down a wave function. You can go to a saddle point here, as Zhang Hansen and Kivelson did, and in a slightly different way, Nick Reed did, you know, in their effective theories for the Laughlin states. You can write down a computer ground state wave function. It takes the following form. It's basically the Laughlin wave function multiplied by some anisotropic factor like this. So whereas the Laughlin wave function has electrons kind of repelling the other electrons away from it in a symmetric way, here that repulsion is distorted. Okay, so the drop in density near an electron is distorted by multiplication by a factor like this. Now you'll notice this is not a lowest Landau level wave function, obviously. On the other hand, you shouldn't expect that from this theory. Okay, this microscopic theory doesn't involve, this particular theory doesn't involve any kind of projection to lowest Landau level. And in any case, the experiment is done in a situation where Landau level mixing is probably very large. The ratio between the Coulomb and cyclotron energies is, you know, larger than one. So that really shouldn't concern us that much anyway. So this is kind of the basic physics of this. And this is a little bit reminiscent, although certainly not the same, as an old idea by Musalian and Joint, where they said, well, let's take this Laughlin wave function, which puts three zeros on each electron, and just split two of the zeros like so. Okay? This also has a pneumatic order, and basically it takes those three zeros and kind of displaces them from each other. And so it's conceivable that these are describing something that in the long wavelength limiter are similar, if not the same. Okay? Which is to say, a state that's completely homogeneous and translationally invariant, but not rotationally invariant, and is still a fractional quantum Hall state. Okay? So just to summarize then, okay, interesting field theories, even some very simple ones, I think can inform our interpretation of experiments. It's also notable that the fractional quantum Hall effect, after all these years, is still producing big surprises. And the combination of these two, I think, is a fertile parade ground, as I'm now learning for at least some string theorists, and also for mathematicians. Or I should change that. To condensed matter physicists, Mike. So thank you very much for your attention. Have to set a good example. Yeah.
You set a wonderful example.
Thank you.
But we can also take questions. Steve.
So, the Lifshitz transition, I usually think of as a transition from a uniform state to a modulated state.
Yeah.
And before you dualize this, there was wave vector. Is there
absolutely
any physical meaning to that wave vector? Is this really a homogeneous state?
In this dual form, it's a homogeneous state, and that wave vector doesn't have a meaning. Yeah. With or without the Chern-Simons term, yeah.
More questions?
Maybe it's a confusion, but so there is still this puzzle for why the resistance in the experiment goes up. So that presumably may have something to do with the solver, which will not be very friendly to the pneumatic state.
Right.
So it's probably some sort of random.
Surely there's there's certainly some rounding due to disorder in the experiment. Now, these are very clean samples, of course, so it may be, you know, that the disorder isn't putting in a lot of rounding. And maybe that's responsible for I don't know. Well, I wouldn't particularly think the disorder would make it more likely to diverge at low temperatures, but perhaps.
Just one comment. Presumably the experiments are still done entirely, the results are entirely in the range where, let's say, Cmax X and Cmax Y are still very small compared to Cmax Y. They've never gotten sort of more of a invert, but
yeah.
You're not getting, it's hard to imagine actually getting to a regime where rho X, rho Y would actually get much larger than rho X Y.
Yeah.
You still have some kind of quantization.
Of course.
So we're very far from that regime.
Yeah.
What will happen is you lower temperature, it's unlikely that it's going to really continue to grow up. Something presumably else is going to happen.
Presumably.
Are there more? Yes, question.
So these wave functions you wrote down at the end, is there some kind of pseudo particle Hamiltonian you can write down that these are the exact wave functions?
Not, you mean like Haldane pseudo potential type of thing? Not that I know of. I mean, these are the wave functions for that, you know, for the basically the mean field Hamiltonian of that Landau-Ginzburg theory. It's not a lowest Landau level Hamiltonian, projected lowest Landau level Hamiltonian, but it's a Hamiltonian certainly.
Well, ones with the separated zeros is in the lowest Landau level.
Yes, it is.
Think of some strange, weird potential, perhaps, that might that make that low. I don't know.
Following up on Bert's question, if you fit the temperature dependence of this increase, would a reasonable person extrapolate value?
You mean the experiment, in the experiment? You know, I'm not going to speculate on that. You should probably just talk to Jim about that.
A short range, it's a short temperature range. First thing I would do would be to put a ruler up next to it and draw a straight line.
Straight line, which would hit zero, would hit zero, but it would hit a finite value, which is still small.